Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello and welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. I'm Alan Saunders.
To the most illustrious and indomitable Prince Charles, King of Great Britain, France and Ireland, Defender of the Faith. Most illustrious Prince, the heart of animals is the foundation of their life, the sovereign of everything within them, the sun of their microcosm, that upon which all growth depends, from which all power proceeds. The king, in like manner, is the foundation of his kingdom, the sun of the world around him, the heart of the republic, the fountain whence all power, all grace doth flow. What I have written here of the motions of the heart, I am the more emboldened to present to your majesty, because almost all things human are done after human examples, and many things in a king are after the pattern of the heart. The knowledge of his heart, therefore, will not be useless to a prince, as embracing a kind of divine example of his functions. And it has still been usual with men to compare small things with great. Here, at all events, best of princes, placed as you are upon the pinnacle of human affairs, you may at once contemplate the prime mover in the body of man and the emblem of your own sovereign power. Your Majesty's most devoted servant, William Harvey, London, 1628.
The dedication to William Harvey's anatomical disputation concerning the movement of the heart and blood in living creatures. It was published in 1628 as Exercitatio Anatomica de Motu Cordis et Sanguinis in Animalibus. So, a book in scholarly Latin and dedicated to King Charles I. It all sounds pretty conservative, but Harvey, who died 350 years ago this year, was anything but a conservative when it came to physiology. He was a revolutionary, and as we'll find out soon, a bit of a philosopher too. In his day, it was believed that the food we eat was converted into blood by the liver and then consumed as fuel. It was also believed that the flow of blood was caused by the sucking actions of the heart and liver. Harvey determined that the heart was a pump, forcing blood through the body, and he proposed that the blood circulated round the body, through the heart, and out again. Well, to talk about the philosophy that underlay Harvey's groundbreaking physiology, here's John Carmody from the School of History and Philosophy at the University of New South Wales and the Centre for Values, Ethics and Law in Medicine at the University of Sydney.
It's always seemed to me, after years and years of trying to be a physiologist and pharmacologist myself, that most scientists don't recognise that there's a philosophical underpinning to what they do. There has to be. If they don't have any philosophical notion of what they're seeking, and Harvey kept in his great book on the anatomical disquisition about the movement of the blood, of the heart and the blood in animals, he constantly was referring to seeking the truth. Now, you know, in these postmodern times, that sometimes sounds a bit unfashionable. But it's also a question of how you seek the truth and whether the truth is attainable and to what extent are you prepared to live with uncertainty. All of those are very important questions in science. And Harvey, I think, saw himself very much as part of the philosophical tradition. But in terms of medical science, I see him as indeed the first modern physiologist. And I see him as one of a troika of three great names who built the structure of medical science on which then scientific clinical medicine could be built. And the first of those was Andreas Vesalius, who in 1543, in my view, began modern medical science with the publication of his book on the structure of the human body. And that made anatomy both modern, by which I mean it was based on critical observation, rather than following dogma and providing adherence to the great names like Galen and Aristotle and so on. It also made anatomy a visual rather than...
It's a beautiful book, isn't it?
It's a beautiful book. It is a great work of art, and it's a reminder of the continuing link between medicine and art, and that it was a philosophical declaration that anatomy is a beautiful subject, and it's a pictorial subject rather than a verbal one. So that's why Vesalius, I think, was terribly important. But the crucial thing is that it was based on his own observations, because I see science as our attempt to understand the physical and biological world in which we live by the most careful, critical observation, and then analysis, as is appropriate for the kind of observation, the best analysis that we can do. Ultimately, it stands or falls by the quality of that observation, and that's why Vesalius's anatomy was so good. Then came Harvey, and I consider Harvey the first modern physiologist for reasons that I'll tell you in a moment. And then in the mid-1840s came Karl von Rokitansky in Vienna, and at the Allgemeines Krankenhaus, the general hospital in Vienna, he did thousands and thousands of postmortems, and in the 1840s published a great three-volume handbook of anatomical pathology. And there we had the three foundations: normal structure, normal function, abnormal structure, which gave us the foundation on which modern clinical scientific medicine could be built. We talk a lot about evidence-based medicine these days, and it's absolutely crucial. But until that scientific platform was established by those three great names, it wasn't possible. And Harvey was the father of our modern understanding of normal function, physiology.
You've named three great figures here. There's about 100 years between the first and the second, and 200 years between the second and the third. This suggests that action in this area was pretty slow.
I don't quite understand why that was. Part of the problem with anatomy, of course, was the legal and the aesthetic and the religious issue of dissection. Part of it, I'm afraid, is also the conservatism of my profession.
Is it also that there's a particular sort of mind, and perhaps it's a philosophical mindset, that is necessary in order to make advances in this area? I mean, between Harvey and the last of the people you mention, there were anatomists, there were the hunters in Britain, there was even Dr. Knox, the man for whom Burke and Hare stole bodies, and, he was a pretty mean anatomist. There were people cutting up bodies assiduously, but was it that they had the physical skills, but they didn't have the cast of mind necessary to make advances?
It has to be partly that, because it's unthinkable that in doing these dissections, often of criminals just after they'd been hanged, of course, to get fresh samples, and they were seen to be healthy and muscular compared with decrepit bodies of patients who'd slipped into some kind of pathological inanition. There were legal issues, of course, but it is a question of that philosophy, and it's possibly partly the philosophy, if you want to call it that, of the physicians, because with the establishment of the College of Physicians in England in Stuart times and similar sorts of things elsewhere, and art often shows us this actually, the physicians became obsessed with the description of the minutiae of disease as they saw it. And the notion that they needed to test that, this is a very, very important part of Harvey's philosophy too. It's all very well to have theories, but you've got to be prepared to test them. And the physicians really didn't have a mindset that thought that, having gone to the trouble of formulating all these fine descriptions, that they needed to do anything more about it. That's a very modern notion.
There's that famous picture, a great favourite of mine, by Rembrandt, The Anatomy Lesson of Dr. Nicolaes Tulp.
And he gets the anatomy wrong, but we won't go into
won't go there. But Dr. Tulp, whose main interest, what he actually published in was pharmacopoeia, but that was his main interest. But, he's basically just exposing a body. What he's not doing, and what Harvey was doing, was intervening.
Absolutely. In fact, Dr. Tulp was exposing a body in most improbable circumstances. Improbable in the sense that he and his students were all dressed up in beautiful costumes, so it's unthinkable that they actually did any of the dirty work. All of the dissection was done by a prosector of some kind, and he was there as the demonstrator. That's right. And to do the sort of intervention that you described meant that you had to get your hands dirty, you had to get your clothes dirty. And that's what Harvey was prepared to do. And many of the physicians saw themselves as really far too elegant for that sort of thing.
And is this what makes Harvey the first modern physiologist?
First of all, his understanding that you have to intervene, you have to do things. Secondly, he had the same mindset that Vesalius had, that is, you've got to intervene not just in doing the experiments, you've got to intervene, as it were, philosophically. You've got to be prepared to say that it's perfectly possible that the great authorities from the past, even my teachers, and he keeps referring to his great teachers in Padua in particular, you've got to be prepared to consider the possibility that they might be wrong. That's a kind of philosophical intervention, if you like. But he was very modern in other ways too, Alan. The first of them, I think, was in turning Vesalius' approach on its head in a way, because Vesalius was saying a lot of the old anatomy books are wrong because they dissected sheep and other animals and then pretended that men were the same. Harvey recognized that while that was true, if you wanted to study anatomy of the human body specifically, but there were a lot of other things you could learn by dissecting animals which are of a different structure from the human situation and try to understand what they showed. So he dissected invertebrates, he dissected shrimps, he dissected fishes, frogs, as well as a wide variety of other animals. So he was a comparative anatomist and physiologist first and foremost, and I think that was a very important thing, that he recognized that you can learn a great deal about the natural world by studying the whole of nature. The second thing is that he understood the importance of measurement. And many of his arguments involve using measurement. He would say, how much does the heart hold? And how many times a minute does it contract? And if it only empties 10% or half each time, how much blood is it pumping out? And if it pumps all that blood out, where's it all going? And where's it coming from? And the only way it can be is if that you've got a fixed amount of blood and it goes around in a circle all the time, like a railway system having only a certain number of trains. So measurement, quantification repeatedly comes up as being part of his argument. That's very, very modern.
It's also very typical of the age in that he draws examples occasionally from basic craft skills. He talks about how butchers know that it doesn't take long to empty all the blood out of a cow.
He does indeed, and therefore the butchers know that there isn't very much of it. And if there isn't very much of it, this is in the context of that same quantitative argument. So he's got the slip between quantitative and qualitative, and if they know that, then there's a hidden message that we should draw on their experience as well.
This truth, indeed, presents itself obviously before us when we consider what happens in the dissection of living animals. The great artery need not be cut, but a very small branch only, to have the whole of the blood in the body drained away in the course of no long time, some half hour or less. Butchers are well aware of this, and can bear witness to it. For, cutting the throat of an ox, and so dividing the vessels of the neck, in less than a quarter of an hour they have all the vessels bloodless. The whole mass of blood has escaped. The same thing also occasionally occurs with great rapidity in performing amputations and removing tumours in the human subject. Still further, after death, when the heart has ceased to beat, it is impossible, by opening either the jugular or femoral veins and arteries, by any effort to force out more than one half of the whole mass of the blood. Neither could the butcher ever bleed the carcass effectually, did he neglect to cut the throat of the ox which he has knocked on the head and stunned, before the heart had ceased beating.
A passage from De Motu Cordis, the great book published in 1628, in which the English physiologist William Harvey demonstrated that the heart pumps the blood around the body and that the blood circulates. On the Philosopher's Zone, I'm talking to John Carmody about the philosophy that underlay Harvey's great discovery.
The other thing that's important, I think, is the form of the argument that he uses. You as a philosopher may think I'm overstating it, but he really does, to me, repeatedly seem to use the argument that, or the form of argument that Karl Popper later came up with, that is, it's hard to be sure that you've got something right, that you understand something is true. It's much easier to prove something is wrong. And Harvey repeatedly keeps saying, well, you may say so and so, but actually, if you do this intervention or you do this measurement, that's not sustainable. And Galen thought this, but if you use the evidence of your senses, he keeps using that phrase, resort to the evidence of your senses, you'll see that this isn't right. So I also think he's very modern in that he was a Popperian before his time, a falsifier.
Well, you say that he was a Popperian before his time.
That's stretching a point, I agree.
Yeah, it might be. But One of the problems with applying Karl Popper's philosophy to actual scientific examples is that a lot of scientific theories seem to come into the world already falsified. So, for example, in the case of Copernicus, who is saying that the Earth revolves around the Sun, well, that means that you think of the Earth at one point and think of it 6 months later, it's 186 million miles nearer or farther away from the sphere of the fixed stars, and there ought to be an angular difference, which is known as the stellar parallax, indicated there. In Copernicus's time, nobody could find a stellar parallax. It wasn't found until the 19th century. So your only way out is to assume that the universe must be so much larger than you hitherto supposed it to be, that the angular difference between one reading and another reading 186 million miles closer or farther away, the angular difference is so small that you just can't detect it. Now, that's an ad hoc assumption that just saves the theory. Similarly, with Harvey, he has to say that there are these tiny vessels through which the blood gets from one side of the heart to the other, but he can't show that they're there. But physiology didn't have to wait as long as astronomy did, because Malpighi came along fairly soon after to show that they were there. But nonetheless, that does look like a refutation of his theory.
Very true, and furthermore, as I say, he was refuting the Galenical idea that there was movement across the partition between the two sides of the heart, on the grounds that with his fine probes and so on, he couldn't find them, but was perfectly happy to accept that there must be links between the arterial and the venous side, which likewise he couldn't find. You don't expect scientists to be totally consistent.
Let's look at his experiments on the movements of the heart. I mean, the first thing to be said, and perhaps this is anachronistic, but the first thing that strikes the modern reader is that this is vivisection, and these are brutal experiments, aren't they?
No question about that. No question about that at all. But then surgery at the time was brutal too. All you needed was a good dose of alcohol and three strong men to hold the patient down, and that's why surgeons were so quick, and medicine could do nothing, and there was a whole different mindset.
But one of the things that has always struck me about his experiments, that he was one of those scientists who just had great experimental ingenuity. I mean, if you think of Newton doing his work on the prism, a lot of people had played around with prisms before Newton. Newton was the first person to decide to do it in a dark room, and that's when you start learning things. Similarly, if you vivisect a sheep to find out about the motion of the heart, the sheep, not surprisingly, goes into shock, and the rate of the heart increases, and it's very difficult to watch.
Oh, yeah, but then eventually, as it starts to die, the heart starts to fail, and everything slows down. And that was something that Harvey was very conscious of, the problem of things that speed up.
But wasn't that why he experimented on cold-blooded animals, where things were slower to begin with?
Things were slower to begin with, and it also, he didn't have to deal with the criticism from his colleagues that if you're dealing with a pathological animal, that is one which is in the last stages of its dying, maybe you're looking at abnormal phenomena. Maybe what you're seeing isn't physiological, as we'd say now, but it isn't representational. Harvey would say, well, I still see the same sequence of events as I do in cold-blooded animals. And he was particularly concerned to refute the idea of the Swiss anatomist and botanist Caspar Bohin, whom we now remember from the name of the plants Bohinia. And Bohin said there are four chambers to the heart, so there are four contractions separated in time. Harvey recognized that the right side of the heart and the left side of the heart contracted at the same time, and that Bohin was wrong. That colder-blooded animals, where it's slower, it's easier to see. And that's why he used frogs, which have got three chambers to their heart, and fishes, which have only two. It had an anatomical advantage, but it also had an advantage that he could say, well, these are normally cold-blooded animals, and I'm not looking at abnormal circumstances. Harvey was extraordinary because he had the creative intellect, the philosophical intellect, if you like, to see where the problems were that needed attacking, to see the issue of using multiple sorts of animals, be a comparative physiologist, but most importantly, to have the skills to do the observations and the dissections, and then to understand the importance of applying numbers and measurements to them. So he was such a great scientist because he had all of these extraordinary skills in the one person.
In the first place, then, when the chest of a living animal is laid open and the capsule that immediately surrounds the heart is slit up, the organ is seen now to move, now to be at rest. There is a time when it moves and a time when it is motionless. These things are more obvious in the colder animals, such as toads, frogs, serpents, small fishes, crabs, shrimps, snails, and shellfish. They also become more distinct in warm-blooded animals, such as the dog and the hog, if they be attentively noted when the heart begins to flag, to move more slowly, and, as it were, to die. The movements then become slower and rarer, the pauses longer, by which it is made much more easy to perceive and unravel what the motions really are and how they are performed.
Harvey isn't anybody's obvious idea of a revolutionary.
No.
He was politically conservative. He
was physician to King James. He was physician to King Charles. He married the daughter of his predecessor as the physician to the king. He knew about, that if you're going to be a scientist you need a good income, so you marry the daughter of the king's physician. He was all about the establishment. That's true.
But there are strong elements of conservatism in his scientific thought as well. Robert Boyle, the deviser of Boyle's Law, who occasionally described as the father of chemistry and son of the Earl of Cork, Robert Boyle says in a pamphlet that Harvey had told him that he was persuaded of the importance of valves in the veins, which mean that the venous valves, which basically means that the flow can go only one way.
Yes.
He was persuaded that they had to be there for a reason, and he said that nature does nothing in vain. Now, the notion that nature does nothing in vain, that's Aristotle. For the time, it's a very conservative idea.
Oh, absolutely. And there were other areas in which he was quite conservative as well. He did a lot of research into reproduction, and a lot of his thinking in reproduction was both very Aristotelian and therefore very, very conservative. Nature never does things without a purpose, but that implies that we fully understand nature from the start. It may very well be that what we think is there without a purpose, a bit like all the talk that's being rethought now about junk DNA. Maybe there is a purpose there that we haven't understood, and we've constantly got to be alert to the fact that we're pushing aside important questions because we think we understand it. And just as Harvey sought to overthrow old doctrine because it implied that we understood everything, and he said in the anatomical disquisition, one of the things I want to do is to show that we actually are ignorant of more things than we know. But dogma is all about pretending that you know it all. And of course, Harvey is a human being, and he's just as capable of spouting dogma as the rest of us.
When I surveyed my mass of evidence, whether derived from vivisections and my various reflections on them, I frequently and seriously bethought me what might be the quantity of blood which was transmitted, in how short a time its passage might be effected, and the like. But not finding it possible that this could be supplied by the juices of the ingested aliment without the veins on the one hand becoming drained and the arteries on the other getting ruptured through the excessive charge of blood, unless the blood should somehow find its way from the arteries into the veins and so return to the right side of the heart, I began to think whether there might not be a motion, as it were, in a circle. The heart, consequently, is the beginning of life, the sun of the microcosm, even as the sun, in his turn, might well be designated the heart of the world. For it is the heart by whose virtue and pulse the blood is moved, perfected, and made nutrient, and is preserved from corruption and coagulation. It is the household divinity which, discharging its function, nourishes, cherishes, quickens the whole body, and is indeed the foundation of life, the source of all action.
David Rutledge reading from an English translation of William Harvey's Anatomical Disputation Concerning the Motion of the Heart and Blood in Living Creatures, first published in 1628. Before him, you heard John Carmody from the School of History and Philosophy at the University of New South Wales and the Centre for Values, Ethics and Law in Medicine at the University of Sydney. The show is produced by Polly Rickard with technical production this week from John Diamond. I'm Alan Saunders, and I'll be back next week with another Philosopher's Zone.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.